So, Simon, here we are. Another episode of Music Maps.
Yeah, and another pin in our map.
So today, our guest is the Penderyn Prize-winning author, Michael Cragg.
Yeah, Reach for the Stars is the book.
So yeah, we're with Michael Cragg. Michael, hello. Welcome to Music Maps Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm pleased that obviously this is not a video podcast. If it was, you'd see that Michael is wearing the Penderyn Music Prize crown.
Yes, and I'm wearing a Spice Girls t-shirt because I tried to do every event that I did for this book, I tried to wear a band t-shirt from that era or an act from that era.
That's very impressed with your Spice Girl t-shirt when we did the event.
Yes, that was an eBay purchase.
A bootleg t-shirt?
I think it's a bootleg one. It was very hot. The material was incredibly cheap and I was incredibly hot. But yeah, it was a year ago, I think.
It was a fiver on Wembley Way back in 1998.
And this is a tip, again, I think other authors should take note of. I kind of feel we've had Bob Stanley three times. Has he come wearing a Bee Gees t-shirt? No, he hasn't.
No.
Stripy top, looks like a mod. That's it.
Classic Bob.
Classic.
But yeah, no, it was a year ago, I think, that we did the event. So the book is coming up to a year, its year anniversary, which is...
Happy birthday, Reach to the Stars.
Feels like it came out about 10 years ago. But
happy birthday, prize-winning Reach to the Stars.
Prize-winning author, Michael Cragg.
So we're going to look at the prize-winning book, Reach for the Stars, of which the major players in the book include Steps, Five, S Club 7, The Sugar Babes, Blue, Busted, McFly, and Hearsay, and there's others. There's more.
Girls so Aloud. If you're wondering why they're absent, we're going to largely avoid the Spice Girls and Girls Aloud on this episode, but we will have a full episode about each of those at a later date. So it's a bit of a left turn as we dive into the world of 90s pop, but the pin in our music map today is actually Princess Park Manor, which may be unfamiliar to some of you, but Michael, where was this place?
That was near a roundabout just outside London, and it's where it was like an old mental asylum,
yes,
if I remember correctly, and that's
was during this period
it became
even more mental.
I've got the facts here, Mark. So it was built in 1849, cost £300,000 to build then.
Whoa.
It was originally the Coney Hatch Lunatic Asylum was its name, shut in 1993, renovated in 1995, named after Princess Diana, which I did not know.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
And then in the 2000s became home to many pop stars, film stars, football players, etc.
Yes. So, yeah, Sugar Babes, Girls Aloud, Busted, maybe some others all sort of lived there.
Blue.
Yeah, when they first kind of were signed and needed somewhere to live. And I think the label thought, how about we keep them slightly outside of London.
Sort of on the edge.
Yeah, I'm sure they can't get up to too much mischief. But obviously, you know, you're not going to stop a bunch of sort of early 20-year-olds from having fun in London, where a lot of them obviously hadn't come from London. They'd come down to London to be pop stars. So that's what they did.
Stick them out in Fry and Barnet.
That was it, yeah.
You never know.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, and it was there that they sort of realised how to live by themselves. Some better than others. You know, yeah. Nicola Roberts didn't understand that they had to pay bills. Didn't have a Hoover. So they were sort of, that's where they learned. That was like their student accommodation.
I can relate though, because when I was that age, I wouldn't have known how to do anything.
Yeah, I didn't even know you. I was sort of shocked when I went to uni and I had to pay like a phone bill. And I was like, oh, how do I do that? I do sympathize with Nicola Roberts.
I remember seeing people washing up in a student hall of residence and being like, what are they doing? What's this?
Why are they doing their own washing up? That place is sort of quite an important part of the story, I guess, because, you know, pop was so massive at that point, post-Spice Girls, that I think they just needed these sort of apartment blocks to house them all and to make them sort of, they knew where they were, which helped, I think. You needed to keep an eye on them a lot. And they were so busy that you needed them to be in one place where you could just send like three cars to take them to wherever they needed
somewhere
to go.
Somewhere near a motorway.
Yeah.
Straight in the car.
And up north to do some radio show.
Well, the busyness is certainly one of my takeaways from reading this book. And we're going to delve into that a little later.
So let's pick this up with the management team of Chris and Bob Herbert, who, after missing out on the Spice Girls, which we'll talk about on another episode, turn their attention to the world of the boy band?
So they come up with Five eventually. I think the idea was that there would be four people, not called Five, and that was the original plan. So the auditions took place in a similar way to sort of...
Were they going
to
be called Four?
Well, I don't know. Probably. I mean, you know, they didn't sort of reach very far for that name. But yeah, they auditioned them. It was like the male version of the Spice Girls. That's how it was billed. Russell Brand went to one of them. And the eventual, they sort of grouped them into these like little groups already, and they accidentally put Five together, the five men that became Five. And they sort of worked out that the way to stand out was to sort of do some rapping, make it a little bit sort of cool and credible. And that worked. And Simon Cowell was involved too from the label side. And he was like, it's those five. And that's when they became Five. And then they were like, let's chuck them in a council flat and get like ITV's Neighbours from Hell involved.
Yes.
Which is sort of how they kind of launched in a weird way, was with this TV show. And inbuilt into that was...
So this was, I think it's a house in Camberley.
Yeah. And inbuilt into that was to make them sort of fight. You know, fighting was sort of part of their whole thing. Like they had fights with their neighbours, they had fights with each other. Like that was inbuilt into the band, which is not going to last a very long time, but it was quite exciting because the rest... was sort of post Take That, it was a bit boyzone-y and no one really wanted that.
All very clean cut at that point.
Yeah, just not very exciting, lots of sort of sensible outfits and sensible songs, and Five were not sensible.
Five, you've said there was some infighting involved, and Five were infamous for it. How much of it was real?
I think it was real. I think part of it was the label sort of wanted this, you know, Westlife Five kind of battle. And, you know, you did have the opposites there of like the clean cut versus the sort of rebels. But I think within that band, you did have clashing personalities. There was a big age difference, relatively. You know, I think Sean was sort of 16, 17, and Jay was sort of 23. And at that period in time, that's quite an important gap. So yeah, they were fighting, you know, backstage at CD UK. The producers and songwriters that they worked with would often keep them separate. So they'd record and write with sort of two of them, and then they'd write and record with like the other three.
What were they fighting about or over?
I think it, you know, going back to the busyness as well, they were just tired and annoyed and sort of not having a lot of control over what was going on. And I think sometimes you look at the things you can control, and if you feel like you could control another band member, then maybe that's what you start to do a bit of. So yeah, I don't think it was fake, but I think it was a neat sort of marketing tool as well. You know, if the label think, oh, well, we've got some like bad boys here, they're going to play that up a bit.
Mental health wasn't something that was talked about back in the late 90s. How does that impact on these young people and the people in Five?
Yeah, so Sean, I think, struggled the most from the beginning, really. I don't think he really knew what being in a boy band entailed. And I don't even think that was really what he wanted. He sort of did his own song at the audition, which I think is quite interesting. You know, he wanted to be a musician. I think he felt like it would take longer to take off. And actually with Five, what you saw was it was almost instant. Yeah. They had a top 10 single 6 months later, or maybe even faster than that. And then they went to America, to Japan, to Europe. They were big in the UK. It all happened at once. And I think for Sean especially, he just didn't necessarily know how to cope with that, and there weren't really places for him to go and talk about it. We looked at fame in a very different way as well. It was like, well, you're living your dream life, like you're in a pop band, you're making money because that's what people think you are doing, you've got like girls falling at your feet, like what's not to love? And I think to sort of stand up and say I'm not enjoying this was a bit like, oh, what's wrong with you? And so I don't think there were those conversations, and so in the end he didn't really have a choice other than to leave or have a break. But you didn't have a break, there was no time, you were on to the next album immediately. You know, they performed when there was just three of them because various members were sort of out of the band, or you know, they were falling apart basically by the end. Sean had gone, Scott had just had a baby that was born prematurely, and you know, there was some issue about whether he could have some time off to be with the baby, and Richard twisted his ankle, which isn't quite as serious, but like there was only three of them performing like one of their last singles, and you were like, oh, this is done.
And I think the big takeaway is you can have as many number one singles as you like, but you know, you've got two out of your band who are really unwell here.
Yeah. And I don't think a label necessarily wants to sort of wait at that point, because they're just sort of a money making thing for them in a really simple way. And there isn't time, especially at that point. If you took too much time in between albums, your fans would just move on. There was so much coming on the horizon that you were like, well, if we wait too long, they'll just move on to another band.
Kind of seems to be a shelf life of about 4 years. A lot of these cases.
And within those 4 years, you'd maybe do like 3 or 4 albums. You'd do tours in between each one. You would, you know, if you're S Club 7, you're filming a TV show in a different country. You're doing all of those things like within that. So it's endless, and you get older as well, obviously, within that period. And maybe you don't want to be in a pop band, obviously, when you're sort of headed towards your mid-20s, because you just want to be cool or whatever, and you don't want to keep being told what to sing and what to do.
So one act that comes along in the slipstream of the Spice Girls is Steps. So this is Pete Waterman.
Yes. Sort of. It was like Pete Waterman was a bit like, oh, fine, like they're not my thing, but I'll sign 5678 for like one single, because he thought it was sort of naff and a novelty, and you know, maybe it would do something. And I think he signed them for like £700 or something, and was a bit like, you go and produce this. And so they did, and they turned it into this sort of mad line dancing techno thing
that sold 500,000 copies.
Yeah, and never made the top 10. Yeah. And I think that was what sort of pricked his ears up a bit, because he was like, well, hang on, this is like hanging around. People are connecting, fans are connecting to the band. It's not just like the song. And so he was like, okay, let's do a bit more. I think loads of line dancing ones got sort of thrown in the bin. And then obviously from there, they sort of found their thing, which was sort of ABBA on speed. And a lot of their songs are sort of sad, like ABBA, I guess, sad lyrics, just turned into like these huge sort of pop songs. And they had something quite sort of sweet about them, I think, the five of them. You know, the Spice Girls had made pop quite young, or they'd attracted a very young audience, and Steps were like, right, this is exactly where we're gonna go, and like we're gonna hit that market perfectly. And it worked so well. You know, they sold albums as well. Not a lot of these acts did at that time.
There's huge success for Steps, and they end up being nominated for the Brits, the best British breakthrough act.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some shenanigans, I believe.
Well, yes.
Tell us about the Brits, Steps, and Belle and Sebastian.
So Steps had taken part in maybe one of the worst things to happen at the Brits in terms of a performance at this sort of ABBA tribute thing, which was them and Billy Piper and Cleopatra and lots of bad outfits. And while they were sort of backstage, their category was being announced. And they, I think, had just figured that they had won. Because I think Pete Waterman was like, you're the biggest pop act. You know, new
half,
pop act.
500,000 singles.
Yeah, you're touring, you're selling out all these venues. Like, you're definitely going to win. And while they were backstage, they were like, oh, this is our one. And then they heard Belle and Sebastian had won. Who, obviously, at the time, were signed to, like, you know, a tiny label. Were only in the pages of sort of Enemy and Melody Maker. Even then, hadn't really sort of, they were a cult thing. And I think everyone was like, who the hell is Belle and Sebastian? But what had happened was that the Brits had opened up the voting to include online voting. So you could vote online. It was one of the first sort of instances of that. And Belle and Sebastian just had all their fans were basically at university at that point, and they all had access to the internet and computers. And so they all voted. And obviously that Steps had a less internet savvy fan base at that point, and so Belle and Sebastian won, and Pete Waterman flipped a table, not literally but like metaphorically, was like, I will never trust the Brits process again. And you know, I think they then got awarded something the next year, which was a sort of made up award as some sort of touring thing, and they were like, fine, but we'll never forgive you.
So this is like an early example of using the internet.
Yeah. And what's quite funny is that now pop fans have sort of harnessed that. And so you'll very rarely see, if that was to happen again now with a pop act versus a sort of like cardigan wearing indie band, the pop act would win by like, you know, 90%, because they can mobilize their fans in a way. But this was such a early indicator of like how you could do it. But it was done by Belle and Sebastian fans, which is quite amusing. So yeah, it was a funny moment of just like, pop versus indie, which is obviously very, a very big thing then anyway, and Steps Lost, which I think everyone sort of thought was very funny. What was quite funny is that the guy from Belle and Sebastian's old label, who I spoke to for the book, was like, yeah, and Belle and Sebastian are still going 25 years later, but where are Steps? And I was like, well, they have just sold out the O2 and they're doing all right. And he was like, oh.
I would imagine that each world would have minimal awareness of the other.
Probably. Yeah, although I think Stuart Murdoch probably finds it quite funny. Maybe he listens to Steps.
Who knows? We'll have to ask him.
Yeah.
So moving on to Innocent Records, obviously there's Billy Piper and Blue.
Yes.
Let's talk about Atomic Kitten. So how do they come together via fellow Liverpudlian and OMD founder Andy McCluskey?
Yeah, so Andy was like, no one cares about OMD songs anymore. Like, what are we going to do? You know, we're sort of aging out of this pop world. They were on Top of the Pops, I think, specifically. And it was a bit like, oh, you know, we should stop doing this. And I think he wanted to do a pop act and he spoke to Carl, is it? From
Carl Bartos,
yes, from Kraftwerk.
Who you go to when you ever need.
I mean, I always speak to him about career advice. and he said, "Oh, the best, like, what's the best pop act?" And Andy was like, "Oh, it's a girl band." And so Carl was like, "Well, that's what you should do." And he was like, "Oh my God, you're right." So that's what he did, and he started to put together a trio of girls for this band, Atomic Kitten. I think are often forgotten.
Maybe. Who knew that Carl Bartos was involved in the formation of Atomic Kitten?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice...
Well, I think in your book, Andy says, Andy McCluskey, you know, essentially Kraftwerk created Atomic Kitten.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a great line.
That should have been on your tote bag instead of Louis Walsh.
And so Kerry was in the band and she was quite an amusing person to be in the studio, I think. But eventually she left. To be quickly, very quickly replaced, literally like 2 days later with Jenny, who was in another band at the time.
Now, as a seasoned pro, Andy McCluskey realises that the only people who make money in music industry are A, the record labels, and B...
Yes, he did. But it's interesting. So the original version of Whole Again is all spoken word, other than the choruses.
Yes, yes.
And so the label were like, we're going to drop this band. Like the first two singles are done, or maybe three are done, like number 9, number 8. The album hadn't come out, but they were a bit like, we need something. Mm. And so Hugh Goldsmith, who ran Innocent Records, was like, give me one more chance. Like Whole Again can change everything. But they needed it to be more of a song and not have this spoken word. So actually Andy, the story goes, refused to rewrite it. And so Hugh got two other songwriters to come in and change it into what it was. And obviously it came out and was number one for, you know, weeks and completely changed their career. But just as that was happening, Kerry was like, I'm out. I'm going to leave. So, yeah, they quickly had to then replace her and just sort of move on as if nothing had happened.
And then I think they break from Andy.
Yeah, so it was actually Andy and Stuart that were sort of put them together and they kind of co-wrote the songs or wrote the songs a lot of the time. But by the second album, I think the girls wanted to try a bit more songwriting. They wanted to sort of try new things. And so they had to sort of unbreak this kind of band, essentially, because Stuart and Andy were sort of part of Atomic Kitten. They kind of were in the band as well as being the writers. So it got a bit messy, I think, and they sort of split. I think legally they weren't allowed to talk to each other for a bit.
A part in the book where one of Atomic Kitten says they had 2 days off in a calendar year.
Yeah.
And there was one schedule they were given that had 40 minutes written down for sleep overnight.
Yeah, and when they had to come back and like re-record some vocals, it was like, you've got 15 minutes to do that, and then you have to go and like guest edit a magazine or like do a photo shoot.
Presumably this sort of schedule is common for anyone who chooses to enter this world.
At that time, yeah.
At that point.
I mean, it's just not... But the problem was, the thing is now, if a pop act had that schedule, they would talk about it in an interview and it would cause a thing and it would become a big thing on social media and everyone would be like, this is disgraceful. But back then, I don't think you would have known that the schedule would almost be like that because they didn't talk about it. They weren't really asked about it. They weren't allowed to talk about things like that. You would be very risky for someone to be on in Smash Hits being like, we're being worked to the bone. Our schedule's ridiculous. We never get time off. Like, we need a break because the label would be like, hang on, this isn't, you know, we don't talk about those things. We just talk about funny things and keep it, you know, pop is escapism and we're having the time of our lives.
What's your favorite ice cream?
Yeah, that kind of stuff, you know, which is important to know. But also, like, it's changed so much that I don't know that the girls in Atomic Kitten would at that point have known what was happening other than like, oh my God, our dreams are all coming true. And then nearly falling apart. And then they get another chance. And so they're just like, let's keep this going. We can't stop. And obviously, eventually, you do have to stop.
The book is filled with funny stories. And one of the ones that stuck out for me was the time when Blue were invited out to Italy for a private performance with none less than Donatella Versace. Yep. Perhaps, could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so they were very excited to get...
As I would
to
be.
Get an invite out of the blue.
They had suits made specifically.
They got to go and like get some Versace clothes made. And they were like, wow, we're going to go to Italy to this like mad event. And, you know, they hadn't been to those kind of events. They go to sort of film premieres, but, you know, not the same. And then when they got there... They were like, well, why is Donatella just sort of staring at us? Like, why is she not being like, Blue, you're finally here. Like, I invited you for a reason. And I think it was Anthony that was sort of like, Simon, like, what's going on? Like, why is she being a bit moody? And then they found out that she did not want Blue. She wanted Blur. And so years later, like not that long ago, the story sort of came up again because I think one of those sort of Huns accounts got hold of it and did something, and Donatella kind of liked it or sent it on to one of Blue and was like, you know, lol. So it's a story that lives on, which I really like. And I think Blue got to go to Italy and go to a nice fancy party.
Exactly.
While Damon Albarn didn't get to do that.
So. Yeah, he was sat at home. So Simon Fuller's parted ways with the Spice Girls by late 1997. And his next project was a little bit different because it ties in with a TV show. Featuring the band members.
Yes. So, S Club 7. I mean, genius in a way to be like, well, five girls, quite successful. Boy bands are quite successful. Why don't we do a mixed gender group? And why don't we also make them more of them? Because then there's more for fans to sort of latch onto. And
more
then
to
let's
be consumed.
Let's give them a TV show. So there's even more for them to do. And then what we'll do is we'll premiere each big song in the show. And so, you know, it was brilliant. And Polydor had a lot of money to spend and it was all very glossy and the songs were so well done and everything about it was sort of brilliant, but it was also exhausting.
So they're filming a TV show and making the music at the same time?
Yeah, so they were signed and then I think it was at like some big fancy launch thing or when they all met each other that it was like, oh, there's a TV show as well, by the way. And you will be going to Miami in like 6 weeks' time and you've got to learn all this dialogue. And yeah, we're filming in America and then we're coming back and then we're recording an album. Then we're going to go on tour. Oh, actually, I don't think they got time to tour for quite a while because of the schedule. So yeah, it was a lot. And, you know, a lot of the other pop stars that I would speak to would always mention S Club sort of being asleep under the table like backstage somewhere, like they'd be curled up in the corner just trying to get some sleep.
That's another common theme. But you don't necessarily need the radio airplay and Top of the Pops and these sort of more traditional forms because you've got your own TV program.
Yeah, and I think the two Simons, Simon Cowell and Simon Fuller, who were obviously all over this era, they realized that you could just go past the gatekeepers of like what is cool and what isn't. They weren't ever attempting to do that, so why bother with them? You know, if Radio 1 aren't playing your song, it doesn't really matter. Like if they're going to be a bit sniffy about it, we'll just go direct to the fans. How do we sort of get this out there without bothering with those people? And they had the songs to sort of do that. You know, there have been other attempts to do this. There was a boy band, I think, who had tried to do a TV show and have music, but the music wasn't very good. And so it never took off. And so it wasn't like an original idea. It was just that the songs had to be great and the songs were great and they were great at sort of showcasing all seven of them.
And the original S Club bow out in 2003. But not before unleashing their first feature film, Seeing Double.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of the bad film genre. What can you tell us about this?
Well, it is bad. So Paul had left. So they're called S Club at this point, and it's directed by Nigel Dick, who did Baby One More Time video and various other videos. And it's written by Kim Fuller, who is Simon Fuller's brother, who also wrote Spice World. And weirdly, it tells the story of a band who were so overworked that they're all exhausted. And so to stop them from not doing stuff, they create this robot version of the band. Yeah. Who obviously will never get tired and never moan and never complain. And so the robot version of the band kind of, you know, are taking over basically. So the real band tried to sort of stop that from happening. And there's lots of like running around in Spain or somewhere. And yeah, it's bad. It is good to watch. It's funny to watch, but it's bad. And Joe was like really injured at this point. And so there are lots of moments where like the band have to do lots of running and then she just suddenly appears in the location separately. And you're like, well, how did she get there? Because she had done so much like damage.
It's like Han Solo in the new Star Wars.
Yeah, he just like beams.
Because Harrison Ford was old. He's basically not moving in any scene.
Yeah, that's true. And so, yeah, she's the Harrison Ford of that film. Definitely.
Now, rather fortuitously, perhaps, this time period coincides with the huge uptake in CD single sales, which comes about really after Elton John's Candle in the Wind.
Yeah, so in 1997, obviously when Princess Diana died and Elton released that song, suddenly like owning a CD single became like a real... they were everywhere. It wasn't just you didn't have to go to a record shop to buy a single. They were in sort of supermarkets and they were like...
They were at the checkout,
and they were by the sweets.
Heavily discounted.
Yeah, and so it became this thing of like this culture of sort of seeing them everywhere. And I think eventually the idea was like kids are seeing them a lot more, and then they would go in and they would be like, oh, I'll have I want a chocolate bar, but I also want this S Club 7 CD. And so CD singles really took off at that point, and you had to sort of buy it on week one and it was cheaper, and then the price would go up in week two, which was obviously because charts were so important that you would need to enter high in week one so that the label just wouldn't sort of drop you, basically. You know, you'd need to be in the top 10. If you weren't in the top 10, you were in serious danger, which, you know, and then Girl Thing, that sort of famous thing with them, which was like a number 8 hit wasn't big enough. You know, everyone thought that would be number 1 because of the way it was sort of marketed. And Simon Cowell was sort of like, this is the new Spice Girls. And then it only got to number 8. Whereas number 8 now would be amazing. Charts were so important and CD singles were huge in sort of the boom of that. And
so it's all kind of driven by these CD singles to a degree.
And plus then on the flip side, albums were like £13.
Yeah.
And so you needed to convince your parents that you loved an album. And you needed like to say like, I love 4 songs on this. Like the 4 singles that I've heard, I love them. Can I have the album?
So there often tends to be acts introduced that are kind of billed as, you know, it's okay to like them, you know, they're the cool alternative, perhaps typified by Girls Aloud. But what about London Records label mates All Saints and the Sugar Babes? Where do they fit into all of this?
All Saints were the cool version of the Spice Girls, or that's how they were sort of billed and marketed. You know, they had sort of more interesting songs in some way, you know, cooler songs. They had the connection with sort of, you know, Naina Cherry and that kind of thing via Cameron McVeigh, who was Naina's husband and worked on her songs. And so there was a lot, like London Records was a cool label. Everything was quite cool.
So he was involved with both of these?
He was involved with both, yeah.
He'd worked with Massive Attack and such people.
And he rescued both albums. I think the All Saints album was headed in like a bad direction. It was losing a lot of money. There wasn't a sort of single, and Cameron sort of came in to give it some help. So yeah, both of those acts sort of, if you saw the sort of bright, smiley Spice Girls and then you saw the bright, smiley sort of S Club 7, All Saints were the opposite and Sugar Babes later were the opposite of that. They didn't play that pop game in the same way. At the beginning, Sugar Babes eventually evolved into a sort of different version of that.
After their 13th lineup change.
Exactly. Once the revolving doors kept spinning and new people were arriving. But at the start, I remember seeing them on Top of Pops and just being like, why aren't they smiling? Like, why are they not doing choreography? This song is like really weird. Like, Overload is so interesting and weird and doesn't really sound like anything else still. So that it was exciting. It was exciting in the same way that the other sort of pop was exciting. It's just a very different way of sort of attacking the pop game, I guess.
Probably not aimed at me, but nevertheless, our ears pricked up and we liked what we saw.
Yeah. And I think the look of both of those acts and the music connected so well. Like, it's all very well having like a good song, but you also do need the band to sort of pull that off. And I think the Sugar Babes looked like the kind of band that would make a song like Overload and All Saints when they started were like, I Know Where It's At, that era, you know, with the sort of the fashion and everything sort of connected and clicked. And yeah, they were, you know, the Sugar Babes were so young, 15, 16 or something when Overload came out, but their first sort of launch thing was in front of lots of older men because it was like Select magazine would write about them and they were in like the pages of Enemy and Melody Maker. So they played a show, I think, I can't remember exactly where it was, maybe the Jazz Cafe or something. And it was like, oh my God, who are all these like older people? Like we thought it would be like screaming teenagers. And they were like, well, you haven't really got to that audience yet. So actually it's just these guys.
Yes. How do we get from that super clean look of Westlife and Boyzone to the scuzzier Busted and McFly?
It was cleverly, I think the boy band, the old style boy band was definitely starting to phase out. I think we had an era of like, people weren't really trusting of that anymore. Something had changed and everyone was like, that's a bit naff. We don't really want choreography. We don't want matching outfits. So very cleverly, like as the sort of American sound was coming in of like, you know, Sum 41 and Blink 182 and all those guys, it was like, well, hang on, how about we sort of turn that even more pop and let's do a boy band that's a bit cooler, a bit edgier. Not really, but like in terms of mainstream stuff, it was, you know, they had guitars. Yeah. They had sort of big eyebrows and they wore like all the clothes of a band that would appear in Kerrang! Magazine, but they weren't allowed in Kerrang! Magazine because they were obviously manufactured. And so yeah, Busted really did sort of give a whole different take on the boy band, which became massively successful. And they were a bit, you know, cheeky. Like what I go to school for is a sort of, you know, wet dream turned into a song. And I think a lot of their songs sort of were like that. And then you did have, then you could be like, boys could sort of like it and not feel a bit weird about it. You know, you wouldn't shout about liking Westlife. Yeah, and you did have within that band two or three songwriters. You know, you did have people that were writing those songs. It wasn't as much coming down from like a label where they were like, oh, you should write about, you know, like triple-breasted women or whatever, you know, which can feel a bit... But actually, these were like three young lads that two of whom lived together that would stay up and just like write these mad songs together. And
so most of the material was written by themselves.
Yeah, because James Bourne was a songwriter.
He's from Busted. Mm-hmm. We should say some of our listeners aren't James Bourne from Busted. Haven't yet read the book.
So Matt Willis from Busted, Charlie Simpson from Busted, and Matt and James lived together. And they would just sit up and write and eat pizza and like do what sort of teenagers do. And they would write these songs. And I think What I Go to School For was an idea that Matt had. And they'd come together and just write them. And Charlie would get involved as well. So it wasn't like they were like three ugly kids that were just given, you know, a guitar. It was like Charlie from Busted. And, you know, Matt was like the rebel one, like a bit like Robbie. So that it wasn't like it was still marketed and created, but there was something about it that was different.
James from Busted and Tom Fletcher from McFly, who was almost in Busted.
Yeah.
They actually wrote some of the songs for both bands together.
Yes. So they would, I think what happened was when Tom, there was going to be four people in Busted, and then when Tom didn't make it and was told, actually, we're just going to do three, they were like, the manager was like, but I'm going to keep an eye on you. Like, don't go anywhere. Like, we'll keep you sort of there. And so he was brought in with James to write some of the songs, and some of those songs were Busted songs. And then eventually when Tom Fletcher was put into McFly, the songs went to McFly as well. So those two bands were like really linked in that way. And obviously Busted didn't last very long, like two albums. So once Busted sort of went away and Charlie went off and did Fight Star, McFly sort of just slipped right into that
and took over.
Yeah. And so there was always this slight thing, I think.
So there can be a distance there.
Yeah, there was like two of them and then there was a third. And obviously Charlie had this other band. And I think James was a bit like, you can do both. And Charlie was like, I don't want to do both. I just want to do Fight Star. And Charlie would be on TV like wearing a sort of, you know, doing Thunderbirds A Go, but wearing a like Bonnie Prince Billy t-shirt or whatever. You know, he didn't necessarily want to be in a pop band. And that was fairly obvious. And so in a way, I think bowing out at that point, rather than like actually going a bit mad and not and ending up hating it completely was probably the best thing to do. The gang thing that we talked about earlier is very crucial because the narrative of that is so much better than we were put together in a room by.
So because there's that artificial element to it.
Yeah, the manufacturedness of it is obviously always a big thing, and authenticity was very big at that point. But at the same time, you know, Busted for that period were authentic in the sense that they did love that music and that was the music they were making. So it wasn't like they were trying to be electronica or whatever. You know, they were doing what they wanted to do. It was just they were on a major label.
I mean, one of the common themes, I mean, we've touched upon it, but it comes through the book, is these acts obviously burn brightly and then they're gone fairly quickly. And there are some casualties of the lifestyle. We've touched upon them, but do you want to expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, some of the saddest stories, I think, in the book are when people are dropped, you know, when they're sort of the label are like, that's it, you know. You can't keep living in the house that you've been living in now for 5 years that we've sort of paid for, or actually you've paid for because it comes out of your advance. and then suddenly that's it. It's done. You know, you need to get your own way home. You need to move out of the house within X amount. And then that's it. And you go from being, because of how much media there was at the time, how many magazines, how many TV shows.
If you've got Addison Lee on call.
Yeah, imagine. Yeah. But you're known by so many people. So you go out the next day and you're no longer Lee from 911. You're Lee that used to be in 911 that no one sort of cares about anymore. Or everyone knows that you've been dropped. Or
I think it was a member of Five who kept a car waiting for an hour while he had a nap.
Yeah,
because not realizing that he was paying for it.
Yeah, because you just don't. You're not told the ins and outs. Or you are, I'm sure. You know, they did go to legal meetings and all of that, but you're not interested in that when you're 18. You don't understand it. I don't understand any of it now. So you get an advance, but obviously you don't make any money until that's sort of paid back. There's lots of stuff that they didn't necessarily ask about or know about.
Clearly, all these young people weren't allowed really to have private lives, were they?
No, you couldn't. You needed to be there for the fans. So the fans need to think that they fancied you and that they could go out with you. So the idea that like a boy band member was gay just wasn't, you know, you couldn't even think about that. You couldn't allow that to sort of be leaked out or anyone to find that out. I mean, straight people couldn't have relationships. Obviously they did in secret, but they couldn't make them public. But for the gay members of bands like H and Stephen Gately and Duncan James from Blue, it was really difficult. They would basically just have to live a sort of secret life.
George Michael was about this same time as well.
Yeah, and the George Michael thing is quite interesting, I think, because it did blow up and it was hugely impactful on his career.
In America. Sure.
The tabloids were sort of awful about it. The headlines were bad. You know, so if you were a gay member of a pop band thinking about coming out and you saw that and you had maybe the label saying, look, let's just not talk about it, which is sort of the same as like denying it, because it was like, you don't have to deny it, but like, just don't talk about it and don't be seen out with a
partner.
That's
going to be really stressful, isn't
it? Yeah, difficult. Really, you're doing so many interviews.
Well, if you think of the partner in that relationship as well, not being acknowledged, I mean, that is going to just lead to its own stresses, aren't there? I mean, so
and you had the band on your mind as well, I think, because you finally got to this point where you're living this dream, but actually something that is true of you, you can't reveal because it might ruin it for all of you. And then you're like, well, I don't want to ruin these three guys' lives either, or four.
And in a world of the paparazzi and a lot of interest in the tabloids in this.
Yeah.
So again, you've got to be really careful, haven't you? If you are in a relationship, someone's got a long lens through the window.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that must be really difficult.
And if you're not in a relationship and you are just out having fun doing what people do, you then have the worry of like a kiss and tell, which eventually is what happened with Duncan James, because the News of the World did come to his team and were like, look, we do have this interview with someone. We're not going to run it because we want Duncan to like come and talk to us about it. But just so that you know, it's ready and waiting to go. Which is a horrible position to be put in, because it's like, well, what do we do? The power of those tabloids was such that, you know, if he'd have gone somewhere else to do it or chosen another way of doing it, that would have been it in terms of their relationship. They would have come for him in an even more, you know, strong way. So it was a really difficult situation. I know that H was sort of out to the rest of the band, but he wasn't out to the public. And so it would mean that when they would inevitably be asked, like, who do you fancy? Lisa would sort of step in and be like, oh, me. You know, like H is mine. Like, he's only got eyes for me. So the band would sort of protect those members and not allow, you know, any sort of thing to go too far. So it was a really difficult time. And I think now we're in an era of, you know, in pop where it's almost cool or interesting. It's like an interesting angle to be, you know, a queer pop star and to have that to talk about. And, you know, it's sort of, it's so different now.
So the acceptance is a lot better now.
I think the acceptance, in a way, it's more that now it can move all the way over to like a sort of, it can feel a bit marketing vibes of like, you know, I would sometimes receive emails and the top line is like queer pop star. And you're like, oh, okay. Have we gone all the way to the point where like that's the be all and end all of this? Like Troye Sivan sometimes can just be, feel like he's being trapped into this sort of thing where like he'll be asked certain questions because he's a gay man and that's all that we really want to ask him, and I don't think that's good either. But certainly like back then, having to lie or just not be who you are is incredibly damaging.
So in 2001, this marks the birth of the TV talent show, which begins as a fly on the wall with pop stars, but it soon changes completely into this slick, glossy TV with Pop Idol and The X Factor.
Yeah, so Pop Stars was the first one, but it was very different. It was, yeah, as you say, like a documentary, really. And Hearsay were the winners and Liberty X were the losers. But that sort of flipped eventually and Liberty X had a much longer career, I think, because they got time to just step away from the speed in which it was done with Hearsay. You know, they needed this song, they needed to go quickly. And Liberty X were like, actually, we don't want to make that kind of music anyway.
The Hearsay album and single both sold over a million.
Yeah, it was absolutely massive.
Absolutely massive for a very short period of time.
Yeah. The follow-up album, I think, arrived sort of 9 months later and didn't make like the top 10. So that's how quickly their career sort of started and ended. And then I think with that, the public turned on Hearsay very quickly. And I think it might be because it wasn't involving the public. They were voted for. There was no voting. They were picked by the experts. It all happened behind the scenes. And then when they sort of revealed themselves, everyone was like, well, who do you think you are? Like, you know, why are you being like a pop star? And they're like, well,
so it didn't,
that's the point
of the
game.
It didn't have the interactive element.
Yeah, and so quickly the next ones became live, like Pop Idol, you would vote, and it involved the public much more. You know, the Will Young, Gareth Gates thing was huge. Like, more people voted on that than they do in, you know, an election or whatever.
First single to sell a million copies in the first week.
So Will Young...
Incredible.
You know, Will, going back to the sort of homophobia, like Will Young was a really important part of that because he, I think, showed people that he was a slightly, it's going to sound weird, but he was a slightly different gay man in the sense that he had been to like university. You felt like he had fully accepted his sexuality, that he had was out to everyone that knew him. And so he sort of channeled that kind of energy. And I think when the tabloids sort of came for him and were like, we're going to reveal that you were gay, he was like, well, you know what, I'll do it, you know, I'm in control of this. And I think that was quite important. But yeah, Will Young, he beat Gareth Gates. That was a bit of a shock. He sort of stood up to Simon Cowell, which sort of started that kind of energy that would happen later in the X Factor, where if you wanted to stand out a little bit, you just had to sort of back chat to Simon. And it just kickstarted everything and it changed everything. All of the manufacturedness of putting a band together was now Saturday night entertainment. And we'd see the workings of everything and how everything worked behind the scenes, or a version of it. Obviously, it was very different.
But there's also this Christmas number one battle with Rage Against the Machine.
Yes. Poor Joe McKeldry.
Yes. He drew the short straw.
He did, because I think, you know, it was just the timing of it. By that point, it was like the fourth or fifth time that it happened.
This hadn't it almost happened with Hallelujah?
Yeah, Hallelujah. There was a campaign to get the original version of Hallelujah. And I think Jeff Buckley's one also charted to beat Alexandra, because everyone was like, how dare you touch this song? And
I think Jeff Buckley's was two.
Oh, okay.
And she was one.
Yeah. So, and because of the way like downloads were working at that point, you couldn't quite do it. They still needed to be, you know, the weighting of it wasn't quite right. So the next year, Joe McKeldry just looked like a sort of easy target, I think. And So there was this campaign to get Rage Against the Machine, this Facebook campaign to get it to number one. And obviously with the way that downloads worked, you didn't need to re-release it physically. You could just make everyone download it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And he did not get to number one at Christmas, but he did get to number one the week after.
But it got a bit predictable because they were getting the number one every Christmas with a
cover, and there wasn't that much thought going into it. And obviously everyone just felt it was really unfair. But then, you know, who are you really punishing? Like, why would you punish Joe McElderry, not Simon Cowell? And also Sony, I think, were involved in both of those songs anyway. So Sony were the real winners. So it's like, who are you really, like, you're raging against the machine. But it's like, I don't think that's what that song is really.
And then by
about.
The end of that era, they're not even releasing albums after winning.
Yeah.
The very end.
Which I think is, shocking, really, because that's the whole concept of the show was like, you'll get a recording contract. And it's by the end, you were just getting like one single.
It's jumped the shark by that point.
Yeah. And you can put a single out yourself now. You know, like, the whole point is you're giving me something I can't get, and it wasn't working. So I'm glad that it came to an end eventually. But for the amount of sort of bandwidth that show took up, it didn't really give us much. Whereas I think, you know, Popstars The Rivals was only one series and it gave us Girls Aloud. So the hit rate, I don't think, was worth the stress of that show. And for what it did to the pop world, which was sort of decimated in a way, you know, Busted and Girls Aloud and the Sugar Babes were sort of all that remained for a long time. And a lot of pop stars just sort of checked out because they couldn't compete with the machine of the X Factor. You had the top five being given record contracts and then coming back the year after. But then by the time they came back, there was a whole new load of people, you know. So it was very difficult, I think, to be a pop star.
So the book ends in 2006. Why did you pick that as the end?
Well, I have to shout out Pop Justice's Peter Robinson, because that was actually his idea. So I was interviewing him for the book, and he was like, well, why is it going from... Initially, I was going to do the noughties, but then I was like, well, how do you leave out the Spice Girls, who obviously came in 96?
You've got to start there.
Yeah, so then I was like, oh, I'll do 1996 to 2009. And then it was like, well, hang on, that doesn't really make sense. And so when I was talking to Peter, he was like, you should end it in 2006. And I was like, genius, because Smash Hits closed in 2006. Pop World finished. Top of the Pops finished in 2006. So all of this sort of stuff that had started, this thing that had been brought in by the Spice Girls had now
all gone away.
Yeah, all of it had gone.
And
downloads were, you know, a huge thing now.
You've got MySpace.
MySpace. YouTube. Like, Lily Allen was about to arrive, and Lily Allen is just a completely different type of pop star. Yeah. So there was this whole new wave of different things coming, and I thought, yeah, perfect, let's stop it there.
Tell us about Louis Walsh's input into this project.
Louis Walsh, what a guy. I was given Louis Walsh's phone number, so I rang him, and he was like, I will speak to you for 15 minutes. And I was like, okay, fine. I was like, right, let's go. And then he said, it doesn't matter anyway, because I do these books and I never hear about them. No one cares. No one's going to read this book. No one reads books anymore. And so we sort of plowed on with the interview. And then at the end, he said, oh, actually, I quite enjoyed that. You can ask me a few more questions if you want. So I got, but by then I was a bit like, I don't actually want to ask him any more questions. But I think I did ask him a few more.
Right, Mark, true or not, did this happen or have I made it up? 5, nearly got to record, Hit Me Baby One More Time.
I'm going to say yes.
Michael, why don't you tell us what happened?
Yes, they were. Because Britney Spears obviously didn't exist at this point. So Max Martin was, I don't know, someone that worked at his label tried TLC, and TLC turned it down. And then 5, and 5 in front of Max Martin said, we think it's and we don't want it. And the label person was like, oh my God. And so they didn't get, And then Simon, I think, tried again, and he was like, I'm giving it to Britney Spears. And Simon was like, who's Britney Spears? That sounds ridiculous. And obviously, it worked out quite well.
He hadn't watched the Mickey Mouse Club, clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like it would have been a hit with anyone, but to go supernova, I think the video was a key part of that.
Yeah.
Speaking as a teenager when it came out, I can tell you the video, you'll be the same, Michael. The video was a massive part of that song.
But 5 also turned down Bye 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 by NSYNC, so I just think they didn't really know what
their judgment
was, going on at that point.
Right, so second one. Given their names are Lee, Anthony, Duncan and Simon, an early name suggestion for Blue was LADS Lads. two or not?
I'm going to say no, because that's just to use the nomenclature of not a, it's Frank. No one's going to call themselves lads, are they?
It was suggested.
Yeah, it was suggested by Anthony.
By Anthony Costa from Blue.
Right. I'm not going to make any judgments about Anthony Costa. He always came across.
Seems like a nice lad.
Oh, he's personable. So nice.
Yeah.
But I think also when you come out with a band name, you are just like, well, where do you start? You know, I think Blue was only because one of them just said Blue and they were like, oh yeah, because you've got like Simply Red. So yeah, let's just do a colour. But you know.
Pink was around at the time.
Yes, and so she was the other one and they were like, yeah, let's just go with Blue.
Shining actress Shelley Duvall starred in the S Club's TV series as their rollerblading landlady.
Sounds plausible to me. I don't think I watched it. I'm going to say yes to this.
It's false. It was Exorcist star Linda Blair.
Yeah,
really?
Which is quite incredible to me.
Crikey.
Final one. Million-selling Hearsay single Pure and Simple was co-written by Alison Clarkson, a.k.a. Betty Boo.
I do believe this is correct.
It is indeed true. Right. At the end of each episode, we each recommend something. It could be something you've liked for a long time, something you've recently discovered. I'm going to go first. Mm-hmm. Seeing as we mentioned him earlier, just for an excuse to mention him, I'm going to recommend George Michael and Wham, just because any excuse to get George into the conversation.
Yeah.
One of my favourite ever people.
And aren't their first two records now available on vinyl?
Oh, right, are they?
The Wham ones, yeah.
I'll have to get those.
Yeah.
John Peel, the first person to play Wham on the radio.
Right. Yeah, incredible. Yep. When we do our Wham episode with Simon Napier-Bell, we'll go over all that, I'm sure. But the first music I ever heard was on tape in the car. It was my sister's tapes, Wham and Bananarama.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
What have you got, Mark?
Because I never prepare for these things. I like The Rest Is Entertainment. And I was just, as we were doing this, I was just reminded, that's a podcast, by the way, Richard Osman and Marina Hyde.
Yes.
And I was just reminded, as we were touching upon the record industry and TV shows, it sounded like the sort of thing I could hear Marina and Richard discuss. So, yeah, I like that. I mean, yeah, it's a goal hanger production. So obviously billions of people listen to that.
Look it up. Have you got anything, Michael?
Yes. It's a BBC comedy called Things You Should Have Done, which has gone sort of viral on Twitter or X today because Stacey from Gavin and Stacey was on a podcast with, I think, Natalie Cassidy, where they just talk about TV. And she really slagged it off. And the creator of the show filmed herself listening to Stacey say all these really mean things about it, and it was very funny. And the show itself is very, very funny. It's about a woman, a young girl, a teenager whose parents die in a car accident, and she, as part of the will, gets given the house, but she has to tick off this list before she gets given it. And there are things just like get a job, like learn how to like wash up, learn how to cook. And it's very, very funny, and it's very surreal and weird. But Stacey from Gavin and Stacey hates it, but I think it's really good.
So thank you to Michael for recording with us today. Reach for the Stars. My pick for the best book of the last year. I said it the day I read it. I predicted it would win the Penderin Prize, which it did.